Lady Justice is a true crime podcast, therefore deals with incidents of violence, disturbing imagery, and explicit content. Listener discretion is advised. The Lady Justice podcast offers their deepest condolences to victims' families and wishes to offer thanks to those who work in emergency services. Hello, my lovelies, and welcome to Lady Justice True Crime and the episode A Plot to Kill. My name is Chantelle, and thank you ever so much for joining me. In this episode, Diane Merritt was stabbed in the heart, and the three other adults in the home at the time were suspected. The investigation would uncover an unusual set of circumstances and led to a jury deciding on whether her death was an intentional act. So, without further ado, here is some of the background on the time frame and location of this case. Let's take a step back in time to 1976, when Queen Elizabeth was celebrating 24 years on the throne, and Parliament was led by the Labour Party, with James Callaghan becoming Prime Minister after the resignation of Harold Wilson. The year would see the country experience a major heatwave, Donald Neilson stand trial at Oxford, and the comic Sid James die on stage at the Sunderland Empire Theatre. We are heading to the historic Naseby in Northamptonshire. It's most famous as being the site of the Battle of Naseby, which saw Oliver Cromwell lead a victory over the Royalists during the First English Civil War. The settlement is 14 miles north of Northampton and has been part of the landscape long before the Domesday Book, with evidence of life there being from the 6th century. Yet it's always had a small population of very close-knit residents. As always, sources are listed in the show notes. Emergency services raced quietly through the moonlit country lanes of Northamptonshire after a report was made via 999 that a woman had been seriously injured at an address in the picturesque village of Naseby. The home, described as a modern, plush, detached property, was just metres from the Grade 2 listed All Saints Church and directly opposite the old vicarage. Yet, as paramedics arrived at 2:50 a.m. on Tuesday, June 15th, it looked less than its usual scenic appearance. As the lights illuminated the driveway towards the front of the house, the attention of the driver was immediately pulled to the porch of the home, which highlighted the double front door. Each white painted wooden door frame enclosed two panes of frosted glass apiece, a larger on the top and a smaller at the bottom. From the site in front of the first responders, they could tell that the home had been the scene of some violence. On the left-hand side of the door, it remained largely untouched. The letterbox glinted in the light. On the right, however, blood was seen dripping down the glossed wood, with the window pane at the top half of the door noticeably smashed. Inside, lights could be seen on, and they would enter the home. As they did, they would find a scene of quiet panic and disbelief. Laid on the floor was a deceased woman who had visible signs of assault. Wearing a pair of jeans and a top, she was saturated in blood from a deep stab wound located under her breast. She would also have visible scratches and cuts across her arms, hands, and face, with some shards of glass still present. Inside the home, there were four other persons: a child of five named Nicola, her mother Carolyn Dunk, a 31-year-old woman named Josephine Conway, and the homeowner, Derek Ivan Merritt. They would confirm to the paramedics that the deceased was 30-year-old Diane Merritt, the wife of Derek. The three adults, Carolyn, Josephine, and Derek, were all naturally shaken as more responders came to the scene, and attempts to talk to them were difficult as shock overwhelmed them. As the greying, bespeckled 40-year-old Derek tried to recall the moments before the call to the emergency services was made, in another room, the ambulance driver, Clive Leach, offered to make the two women a coffee to calm their nerves. They would accept, and Clive would go into the kitchen of the property. Now, I'm sure you've all been in an unfamiliar kitchen before, opening and closing cupboards and drawers, trying to find sugar, cups and teaspoons. It was much like that, as Clive tried to navigate his way around the Merritt kitchen. It was at this time he would find something that changed the course of not only the night, but of the following few months. On opening a drawer filled with items of utensils and cutlery, he would glance over a large bread knife, distinctive due to its serrated edge. He thought nothing of it, yet as his eyes passed over it again, there was something about it to take heed. The surface of the blade was different from what he was expecting. The shine of the silver metal seemed to be disturbed by a liquid. That struck him, his mind running the curiosities of the blade in amongst the other inconspicuous kitchen items. Why was it wet? It would be preposterous, especially so given it was past 3 a.m. and from the state of the scene, that somebody would be doing a spot of washing up. It was peculiar also that whoever had cleaned such an item had also placed it back in the drawer still wet, without a courtesy wipe with a towel. It was most out of the ordinary though, with all considered, that the long blade was tinted not just with a clear liquid, but one with a red tint. Had Clive Leach found the weapon that killed Diane Merritt? He would speak to an attending officer, who in turn would speak to the lead investigator, Detective Chief Inspector Mike King. He had set up his investigators in an incident room at Daventry Police Station, 14 miles south, to try and conclude the true set of events that occurred at the home known as Hidden Well. Over the following few days, newspapers were filled with details of the investigation thus far, with evidence from the post-mortem giving the cause of death as shock and hemorrhage following a stab wound. The home facing the vicarage was still cordoned off by police, with the blood-splattered door in sight from the pavement. Nearby, residents would continue to be visited by detectives in door-to-door inquiries, whilst forensically trained investigators were seen removing items from inside the home. 12 detectives from Towcester and Daventry were brought in with tracker dogs. Outside the home, the drive and the entrance were blockaded by a number of police cars. Uniformed officers stood on guard as detectives were seen coming and going. Journalists were kept at bay and the scene hidden from their view with a makeshift screen of 3 sun lounges giving cover to the broken front door. Derek, Josephine and Carolyn were asked to accompany detectives to the station to help them build a picture of Diane, being placed in separate interview rooms. Investigators would begin to learn about the life of Diane Merritt, who had been born on May 17, 1946, in Bradford as Diane Stephanie Roberts. She would be described as an attractive housewife in the media, whilst others, such as an unnamed neighbour, would call her a very, very nice, quietly spoken woman. Diane, before her marriage to Derek in 1975, had had a successful career as a professional female wrestler. She was an animal lover too, and at her home in Naseby, she had a pet cat and dog, whom she adored. Her husband Derek, who owned a do-it-yourself store in Northampton, had fallen deeply in love with Diane, who had a strong personality and a passion for life. The couple had settled into their home just 18 months before and had yet to have children. Though the investigators were gaining more and more information into the background of the woman, they would find that she was a far more complex character. The two other women who had been present when Diane's lifeless body was discovered had disclosed that Diane was not heterosexual, but had enjoyed relationships with women also. This news was relayed in questioning with Derek, who would also confirm his wife's sexuality, stating to the detectives that he was aware and accepting of this. He would also go on to state that he and his wife, 10 years his junior, would often sleep in separate beds too. Derek would explain that over the course of their relationship and subsequent marriage, they had spoken openly about such. He also admitted that the couple experienced issues connecting sexually, and even 18 months into their marriage, had not yet consummated such. Naturally, Derek, as Diane's spouse, would be the first person suspected of inflicting the stab wound to her. The evidence that the marriage was unconventional by society standards had also given cause of alarm to the investigators. The other women present at the time of Diane's death were openly out as lesbians. This, paired with the information that Diane herself was a bisexual and had not consummated her marriage, made officers believe that there was more to the relationships between the women. Mr. Merritt would also speak to his relationship with both Josephine Conway and Carolyn Dunk. He would state that they had been friends of Diane's, who had previously lived with them, with the two women sharing a room in his home for a period of time. Carolyn's young daughter also had a room in the Merritt home. Asked what they were like as lodgers in the home, he said that he liked the women, but would often hear the pair argue behind their door. It had been an often occurrence until they had subsequently moved to the new home. Josephine had been a long-term friend of the deceased woman, knowing her for 12 years, and Carolyn had begun her friendship with Diane just 3 years before. The women had relocated to the city of Manchester, sharing a flat at 14 Dean Avenue, Prestwick. There, they settled into their home, with Josephine Conway taking employment as a part-time disc jockey. Both women admitted to having difficulties in their relationship at times, especially so when not having their own space when speaking with police, but had continued a good relationship with both Diane and Derek. A shocking accusation was presented in interviews with the women, however, that shed even more light on Derek as a suspect. Both women independently told detectives that Diane Merritt was plotting to kill her husband. Each woman would recount tales of how abusive Diane was to her husband. Carolyn would describe what Diane's behaviour was like towards her husband, stating that she was very bad and unfair. They would both also describe attempts on Derek's life that they had witnessed, including a trip to the coast, where, when stood on top of the cliffs, she went to push him over the edge. She only refrained because Derek had turned to face her in the nick of time. Another shocking moment was revealed by the petite blonde Dunk when she watched as Derek almost drowned in a swimming pool. Diane was aware that he could not swim. Carolyn would later refer to her as the coldest and most evil woman I have ever met. Had it been possible that Derek realized that his own wife had planned to kill him, and under strain, in a less than ideal marriage, killed her with a knife to the heart? Quickly, the investigators dismissed this. He had not killed his wife, but had witnessed her death. Derek named Josephine Conway as Diane Merritt's killer. The pretty, dark-haired Josephine would disclose to the detectives in her interview what happened. After taking a visit with the Merritts, the young family had planned to return home to Manchester, taking the 120-mile trip via train. Diane bundled the girls into her car as the evening drew in, as she had previously agreed to drive them to Rugby Station. Disaster struck, though, as they arrived just 10 minutes late for their train, leaving them stranded. Diane offered her home to them and they drove back. Josephine would explain that after the group returned from the train station, she decided to retire to bed, as she felt that Carolyn was in a bitchy mood. She told the officers that she arose around an hour after, wearing only her t-shirt and briefs, and went downstairs to have a cigarette. As she was descending, she could hear the voices of Diane and Carolyn, but paid little attention to their conversation. As she returned, she went into the lounge where they were sitting, giving them a startle, it being the early hours and them expecting all to be asleep. Josephine then said she'd made a joke with the pair that she'd actually been earwigging, before asking Carolyn if she was going to join her in bed. Yet she wasn't to receive an answer, as her offhand comment regarding listening in had clearly upset Diane. She was to later say of this exact moment, "Mrs. Merritt jumped off her chair and punched me. She got me by my head and dragged me from one end of the room to the other. She finally released me and I went upstairs to get dressed. She had told me to get out of the house." It was then, just as she was approaching the top of the staircase, that she became aware that Diane was chasing her, and only a few steps behind. Investigators pushed for what happened next, with Conway stating that she grabbed the banister and kicked out at her. She made contact and she witnessed Diane stumble on the step, dropping an item that she had in her hand. As Diane regained her footing, Josephine said that she picked up what Diane had dropped, not aware of what it was, before looking up and seeing Diane approaching her again. She, holding the item that Diane had been holding, made contact with her. Diane's eyes went wide as panic engulfed her face. It was then Diane rushed down the stairs, but with no balance, crashing into the front door located at the bottom. Miss Conway, even after more than 36 hours in custody, being questioned by lead detectives, would say that she did not know what was in her hand until Diane had run into her. She only realized that she was holding a large bread knife when she looked down. She subsequently dropped the weapon. She maintained that it was Mrs. Merritt that had brought the knife up the stairs, and that she had picked it up, never stating that she had intentionally taken the knife upstairs. However, there was a possibility that she had. When the argument broke out between the women originally, Josephine had requested that Carolyn would join her in bed, be it the early hours of the morning. That evening, on the return from rugby, Josephine had also admitted to having been in a disagreement with Dunk, leaving Conway to maybe suspect that there was more to Dunk and Merritt's relationship. After the disagreement became more heated, the conspiracy to kill Derek was brought up. Diane was upset that Josephine had told Carolyn, upset that her secret was shared, even though Dunk had not exposed her and still became closer to her. Josephine, in her anger after being attacked whilst on the stairs, had threatened to tell Derek of the plan so that he could divorce her and spare his life. On Wednesday the 16th of June, Detective Chief Inspector Mike King was questioned about the status of the investigation and whether the two women who had been quoted as helping police inquiries had been released. He would say that at this point, no charges were being considered. This said, a special sitting of magistrates was heard in Daventry on the following day, in which Josephine Conway would be remanded for 8 days by the chair of the bench, Mrs. Cicely Hughes, on suspicion of murder. She would again be seen at Northampton Magistrates the following week to be officially charged with murder, having her committal hearing at the same court less than a month later. The trial would take place at Northampton Crown Court, beginning on Tuesday, October 19th, 1976, with Mr. Justice Talbot overseeing the case. The trial, however, did not just have one indictment, or even one defendant, as Josephine was joined on the dock by the 27-year-old mother, Carolyn Dunk. Miss Dunk had been later charged with impeding police by attempting to hide evidence, that being the bread knife that had been stabbed through Diane's heart. Both women would plead not guilty to their respective charges. The 6-day trial would open with the prosecution's case being led by Mr. John Owen, Queen's Counsel. The case outlined complex relationships between those in the house at Naseby, explaining further how an argument erupted. His case would primarily rest on the statement made by Derek Merritt, medical evidence provided by the pathologist, and the inconsistencies in the accounts of the two women on trial. Owens would place emphasis on the sexuality of the women, describing both the victim and defendants as lesbians. This was used in part to prove the prosecution's theory as to motive, with a crowd suggesting that Josephine had felt anger towards Diane because she was inserting herself into hers and Dunk's relationship. It was claimed that as Diane and Carolyn grew closer, Conway felt jealous, and after hearing the pair downstairs when she awoke, she retrieved the knife from the kitchen and kept it in her possession as she went upstairs so that she could willingly and purposefully kill her former friend. According to the prosecution, only Josephine Conway could have taken the knife from its usual place in the kitchen drawer to it being used in a fatal attack at the top of the staircase. The prosecution's star witness would be Derek Merritt, Diane's husband. He would explain, when taking the stand, how he had gone to bed that evening, yet had been awoken in the early hours by sounds of raised voices on the lower level of the house. Derek decided to get out of bed and descended the stairs, entering the lounge where his wife was in the company of Miss Dunk. He would walk into the living room, taking in the scene, as his wife was leaving and starting to ascend the staircase. He told the judge and jury about what happened to Diane next from his perspective. As I got back to the door, she came hurtling down the stairs and went part the way through the front door. She recoiled back and fell to the floor. There was blood on her arms and over her top and jeans. He would then testify to hearing Diane's voice cry out, "The bastard stabbed me," before Josephine would shout from the top of the stairs for the attention of Carolyn, "Don't let him phone the police," clearly regarding Derek. Patrick Russell, Queen's Counsel for the defence, would cross-examine the witness, asking him if he felt like his wife had been plotting to murder him. Derek replied honestly, "I am satisfied that she might have been, but I'm not certain." Further details into their marriage was also discussed while Mr. Merritt was on the stand, and he would say that Diane was, quote, "very strong and could be violent," adding that there had been an occasion of domestic violence when she had threatened him with a knife. The trial would also reveal the fact that Diane Merritt had, in the months before her murder, taken a, quote, "very extravagant" life insurance policy out upon her husband. The policy would pay the beneficiary a sum of $25,000, which increased to a total sum of $50,000 if the death was accidental. That's a total of around $136,000 to $272,000 in the current financial market. The policy was confirmed by Derek in the court, who agreed that it was Diane that had made the arrangements for such. He would tell the courtroom how he had no desire for the policy, which was very expensive. He was still paying for such and had made arrangements to cancel. This policy would lend more credence to the accusations of Mrs. Merritt having possible reasons to kill her husband. A statement that Carolyn Dunk made to the police in the early part of the investigation was used in the trial as part of the evidence. It would state, "Diane only married Derek for his money, and she wanted to get rid of him for his money. They met at Coventry Bowl. She came to Manchester with a friend looking for a hitman, but he got arrested the day that she went up there. She intended to get rid of him from the start. She had thought about using pills or pushing him over a cliff. Diane became angry with Josie for telling me about the plan. That was what some of the argument was about. Regarding the night in question, Derek said that he never witnessed his wife go into the kitchen, or even in the direction of the kitchen. He told the police, and again in the trial, that he believed there was no way for Diane to have retrieved the knife, and that it must have already been in Miss Conway's possession when he'd first gone downstairs. That's when his wife was in the lounge and Josephine on the stairs. The Crown's case would highlight that in the early stages of the investigation, Carolyn Dunk had also indicated the same in her initial statements with police. It wouldn't be until later that her story to the police would change, and that she added a detail. She would later add that she saw Diane, before making the ascent up the stairs, go in the direction of the kitchen. But she did not see the knife beforehand. Dr. Peter Andrews, the Home Office pathologist who had conducted the post-mortem, would testify that in his opinion, the bread knife would have had to be held by another person who would have had a, quote, firm grip on the weapon. He would also state that the knife penetrated through Diane's body, and although she was, quote, mortally wounded, her death was not instantaneous. The long, serrated blade entered Diane's body just under the left breast, and she would have stayed conscious for a few minutes after the attack, and could have possibly been mobile at this time. When in the witness box, he was questioned about the forensic credibility of the story that had been told by Miss Conway to the police. She had told of kicking Diane in the torso as the housewife was approaching her up the stairs. It was said that the force of the kick had been enough to leave Mrs. Merritt unsteady, causing her to stagger and drop an item from her hand. The pathologist referred to his post-mortem, which concluded that there were no bruises on the upper part of the body, yet conceded to the defence counsel, Mr. Russell, that a lack of bruising could have occurred if Jacqueline was barefoot, which on the night of the murder, she was. Miss Conway was also to take the stand during her trial for murder. She explained the moments before the deadly attack. When she had decided to go upstairs and get trousers, she could hear Diane calling out from behind, "I'll kill her, I'll kill her." She told the jury in her own words what happened next. "I went to the door and I saw her coming up the stairs. She looked wild. I kicked her and I heard something drop. I looked down and I picked it up when she came running at me. She said I had stabbed her. She swayed back to the wall and ran down the stairs. It all happened so quickly. I didn't realise it was a knife until I had got hold of it." Evidence would be given to the state of Conway when she was found at the scene earlier that year. Both the ambulance driver, Clive Leach, and another doctor who would examine Josephine shortly thereafter would say that she had visible scratches and grazes on her neck. Sergeant Malcolm White would also be called to give testimony, and he would state that Josephine had made a verbal statement to him late on the morning of the murder. "She came up the stairs after me. When she got up to the top, I kicked her and sent her back down." When Miss Conway was cross-examined by Mr. Owens, it was insinuated that she, Josephine, had in fact taken the knife intending to kill Diane, as she saw her as a threat to her relationship. Carolyn and Josephine had been living together for 3 years by 1976 and had previously explained that they had a strained relationship when living with a Merritt couple before. But Josephine would tell the court much the same as she did the police before, saying that she didn't know it was a bread knife until she had picked it up, and she never originally had taken the item from the drawer. Under the cross-examination, she would admit to have held the knife and that she would have thrust it forward when she came into contact with Diane. She told the jury, "I helped stab her." She said, however, It was an act of self-defense. Her defense counsel had previously asked her what would have happened if she had not defended herself, and she said plainly, "I'd be dead." Before she left the witness box, Miss Conway was requested by the prosecution to hold the bread knife produced in evidence and show the courtroom how she had held the weapon when she stabbed Diane. An upset Josie would refuse, instead using a folded envelope to make her demonstration. Carolyn Dunk was also to testify. She would speak to the night of June 14th, saying that when Miss Conway had told Diane that she would tell Derek of the plan to murder him, Merritt had gone, quote, berserk. Regarding the charge that she was indicted for, removing the weapon used in Diane's death, she would state that she had only done so as she reacted out of panic, unsure what to do, and said that she had no intention of swaying the police investigation. She told of how she retrieved the knife, gave it a wipe, and replaced it in the drawer. She admitted that it was a stupid act, but blamed her actions on the distressing scene that had unfolded, and at the time that she picked it up from the landing, she was unaware that Diane was dead. The Crown would use their closing speech to remind the jury that the crux of the case was who had possession of the bread knife first, Diane or Josephine. He would quote the medical evidence and further state that the jury should trust the testimony given by Derek Merritt rather than the two defendants, who, in his opinion, had been proven to be unreliable and untrustworthy. Russell, for the defense, would refer to Diane Merritt as, quote, cunning, unpleasant, plotting, and unfaithful, before trying to reason with the jury during his closing speech. He would question them. Why did Diane Merritt go upstairs if it was not to attack Josephine Conway? Do you think she was going upstairs to brush her teeth? Why should Josephine Conway take a knife upstairs to lie in wait for her victim? Was it any safer to kill her up there? Would killing her upstairs enable her to escape more readily or cover up the clues? At the end, he would request that the jury return a verdict of justifiable homicide or that of an accident, given that his client, Miss Conway, though admitting to holding the knife at the time Mrs. Merritt was killed, was only acting in self-defense. This was less than impressive for Mr. Justice Talbot, who used his summing up to the jury to outline the case and considerations for the jury. He would say that reviewing the evidence, there seemed to be little that supported the defendant's supposed defense, given that, quote, extreme force that would have been required to have penetrated through Diane's body, as stated in the post-mortem evidence. It would be in the afternoon of Monday, October 25th, that the jury would return to the courtroom with their verdicts against the two women. Josephine Conway and Carolyn Dunk had both been found not guilty for their accused crimes and released from custody. The press would accost Josephine as she was leaving the court. She was stopped by the reporters as she was stepping into a car to drive away. She said, "I didn't think they would believe me, but I was telling the truth. Diane was my friend, and I am sorry she is dead, but I think she would have killed me, and I'm sure she would have killed Mr. Merritt." Shopkeeper Derek would also answer questions. Regarding his feelings towards both Josephine and Carolyn, he said that he held no ill will towards them and stated that he believed he wouldn't see them again. Talking about his relationship with Diane and the supposed conspiracy to murder him, he said that the incident with the swimming pool had been, quote, blown out of all proportion during the trial. He would go on, "I never thought my life was at risk. The police, though, are convinced I had a lucky escape. I don't doubt that Diane thought and talked about getting rid of me, but I do doubt whether she really would have carried through with it. I do not regret marrying her. She was the most remarkable woman. No one has been able to stand up for her. I don't say Diane was innocent, but she was not as bad as she'd been made out. Derek would also reveal that he had planned to stay in the home in which Diane had died, telling the reporters, "The people from the village have been very good to me, and my friends have stood by me." So, with that, it brings us to the end of the episode, named A Plot to Kill. Of course, we take time to remember Diane Stephanie Merritt. Before we depart, I just want to say thank you for all of your continued support. I know the show hasn't really been consistent for some time, but I haven't stopped loving doing the show, and you guys are truly awesome. I'm excited to say that I will be meeting some of you lovelies at CrimeCon in London in just a few days. And if you are attending, please come find me on Podcast Row. I'd love to say hi. Now, if you are listening on the day of this release, you still have mere days to get a ticket. CrimeCon UK is partnered with CBS Reality, the home of expert-led true crime television. So you know the weekend is going to be filled with the best content from some of the world's premier true crime professionals. It's a wonderfully friendly environment with fellow true crime buffs that has hours of content spread out across the weekend. It's not something you want to miss. Now, of course, if you will miss this summer's event in London, you may be disappointed. But CrimeCon, again partnered with CBS Reality, will be in Glasgow for a special one-day event on September 10th later this year. It's going to be an intimate get-together with some of the biggest names in true crime, with hours of specially curated content for the biggest true crime fans. I'm going to be there and I'm super excited. Look at some of the guests already announced. I can tell it's actually going to be an event to remember. Tickets to both London, if you're quick, and of course Glasgow, can be found on the CrimeCon UK website. That's crimecon.co.uk. If you would like to get an extra discount, the lovelies behind the events have given the listeners of the show a lovely 10% off if you use the code LADY. Just quickly now, before you get bored of me yabbering on, a quick act of kindness. Let's try and balance out those scales somewhat by making a meal for someone you love. Whether it's beans on toast or a far too bigger portion of lasagna, invite someone you care about for a talk and some grub. It could really brighten up someone's week. With that, go be good people, go be kind, go be safe, and most importantly, go be happy.